The night may be long and the dark may be deep, but the answers are there to be found. Whether it's the normal, the abnormal, or the paranormal, you're in the right place. Let's go beyond reality.
Sometimes it's the normal, sometimes it's the abnormal, and sometimes it's the paranormal, but it's always beyond reality. Welcome to the program. I'm your host, J.V. Johnson. Thank you for being with us tonight. We've got a great discussion for you with Dr. Andrew Silverman from the UK, actually. Dr. Silverman is a recognized leader and a scientific expert on the Shroud of Turin. He's also a medical doctor, and he has a background in physics. And for over 30 years, he's been conducting research on the mind-matter continuum, near-death experiences, and the Shroud. And he's presented his findings in peer-reviewed scientific papers and at international scientific conferences. So that's what we'll be talking about tonight. In addition to some other things, as a medical doctor, obviously I want to get his opinion on what's happening in the UK or even globally as it relates to the pandemic that we're all dealing with right now. So it's going to be a fascinating discussion. Before we bring him in, though, I do want to remind you to go to YouTube and subscribe to our YouTube channel. It's free. There's no obligation, nothing, but it gives you an ability to connect with our online community and access to hundreds, in fact, probably about 600 back episodes of Beyond Reality. It's a great way to catch up on topics that you're interested in because they're all there. So go to YouTube, search for JV Johnson. The name of the channel is JV Johnson's Beyond Paranormal. It's easy to find. Subscribe to it. Click the notification icon if you want to be alerted when we go live, when we stream the program live, or we upload bonus content. We do both of those quite often. Also, find the podcast version of the show. That's also a great way to stay in touch with what we're talking about. The podcast can be downloaded to your smart device, your phone, your tablet, whatever it happens to be, automatically and ready for you to listen to whenever it's convenient. And those are available at every major podcast distribution platform, including Apple Podcasts and Google Podcasts, Spotify and others. So, again, thanks for doing all of that. And thank you for supporting the show. We greatly appreciate it. Really do. So, again, tonight we'll be talking about the Shroud of Turin, near-death experiences, the mind-matter continuum, all with Dr. Andrew Silverman from the UK. That's coming up right here on Beyond Reality. Don't go away. Looking for our guest's book? Go to amazon.com/shop/JVJTaps. Welcome back to the program. It's Beyond Reality. Again, I'm your host, JV Johnson. Thanks so much for being here with us tonight. We have a fascinating discussion planned for you. From the UK, we've got guest Dr. Andrew Silverman. We're going to be talking about themes and content of his book, A Burst of Conscious Light, Near-Death Experiences, The Shroud of Turin, and the Limitless Potential of Humanity. Dr. Silverman, welcome to Beyond Reality. Thanks so much for being here with us tonight.
Thank you also. It's great to be here.
So the first thing I have to ask you, just because of what we're seeing, what we're feeling, what we're experiencing around the world today, you're a medical doctor. And are you a clinician or a researcher?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm a clinician.
Yeah, I'm sorry. What are you seeing in regards to what we would consider to be rather unprecedented, at least in our lifetimes, a medical situation around the world with this pandemic we're dealing with?
Well, yes, it's getting worse, of course, with time, and the incidence is going up as well as time goes by, and so we've had to sort of scale back a lot of our medical services to avoid unnecessary contact, really, to protect the clinicians, but also to protect the patients from meeting other people in public places, such as a clinic, where they might catch it from someone else.
This is a very pointed question, and answer it or don't answer it the way you feel appropriate. But does this particular virus, this particular pandemic, scare you?
Well, I think it's a good reminder of how much we take for granted. That there's an old saying amongst, for example, the Tibetan Buddhists, that we're always just one heartbeat away from death. That we tend to live all the time, sort of denying our own mortality, and something like a pandemic does sort of remind us of it a little bit.
How is the UK faring throughout all of this? I know it's getting a little bit crazier than we expected here in the United States. Was the UK prepared for this?
I'm not sure that anywhere was really prepared for it, to be honest. I mean, it hasn't got as quite as prevalent here yet, but I'm sure it will do because it's going up exponentially. It's sort of doubling every few days.
Last question about this, and we'll move on. Do you see any light at the end of the tunnel?
Well, yes. I mean, firstly, it's not going to infect everyone. And secondly, most people who get it will have a mild illness and then they'll be immune to it. But that doesn't help for people who are grieving the tragedy of the loss of a loved one, of course.
Yeah. Does that immunity, does it last a while? Do we know? It's not like the chicken pox. You get it once and you won't get it again.
I'm not sure anyone knows because this is a new virus, yeah. But it's what I've heard the virologists who are speculating about it suspect that it's quite possible it gives lifelong immunity, but if not, then it could be at least a year, and yeah. Hopefully there'll be a vaccine by then.
Well, that's interesting. Thank you for answering those questions. This must be an incredibly busy time for you. All medical professionals around the world are experiencing demand and stresses probably that they've never experienced before. So thank you for doing this. Let's talk about your other work, though, the work that we scheduled to have you on the program about. You've been researching, and I'll quote you, mind-matter continuum, near-death experiences, and the Shroud of Turin. Are these related topics, or are they three distinct fields of study?
Well, actually, the book shows, I would say, how they are, in fact, related. For example, if we're trying to understand the nature of consciousness, and the question has to come up and is at the front of people's minds, if you like, is consciousness just an artifact of the brain? And of course, for example, near-death experiences would suggest otherwise, that when the brain waves are flat, people are conscious and experiencing laying down new memories and experiencing things that they couldn't have known about physically, such as describing specific details of their own resuscitation that were happening while their brain was not functioning at all. And it has suggested to many researchers that consciousness cannot be a product of anything material. It has to be something fundamental. And in fact, many scientists in the field of quantum theory at the outset of quantum theory, people like Planck and Schrödinger and so on, were very strongly of the opinion that consciousness is fundamental and not made by matter. And more recently, there are people such as the very highly esteemed professor of physics at the University of Stanford, Andre Linder, who has gone on the record publicly to suggest that reason and science do point to the fundamental nature of consciousness, that perhaps it does not rely on matter at all, but the other way around, that matter relies on consciousness.
And that's a fascinating concept. And let me ask you, is another way to describe that by saying that our consciousness is not a biological function?
Yes, it's not a function. It's not a biological function or a material function.
Interesting. You have been researching this and discussing it for quite some time, 30 years. But you recently decided to write a book. What? How would you summarize the book? And what made you decide to publish it at this point?
Well, actually, it was after I had given a public talk on the image on the Shroud of Turin and how I suggested it might have got there, and then that led me to think about writing. And initially, it was a book about the Turin Shroud, but I realized that to do that subject justice, to address it properly, one would need to try to understand how such a thing could work. Because right from the outset, I didn't want to follow the line of either mystery or dogma. So I wanted to see what reason and scientific evidence would suggest together with rational thought. And it seemed to me that that, I mean, after, I should say for those listeners who might think that the carbon dating 30 years ago suggested that the shroud was actually medieval, that they may not be aware that a leading scientist at Los Alamos Research Laboratories by the name of Raymond Rogers found scientific evidence to confirm a theory of two researchers from the US called Sue Benford and Joe Marino, that actually the area of the shroud that was carbon dated was not representative of the rest of the cloth. It was actually had been repaired and consisted mostly, in fact, not of the original material, but of much more recent material that had been sewn in the 16th century. So the image that's on there, which scientists who have looked at it, for example, at the Atomic Energy Institute in Frascati in Italy, a team led by Dr. Paolo Di Lazzaro, a physicist there, which suggests that the image seems to have formed by a short burst of intense radiant energy that came from the dead body of the man that the cloth once wrapped. And so the question is, how could such a thing happen? And if it's all the evidence sort of forensically and so on points towards the individual who was wrapped by the shroud being actually the historical Jesus of Nazareth. Now, I as I say, approach this from a rational standpoint rather than a religious one. And I was wondering, you know, is there something about what this man taught and how he lived that might be a clue to how a human being could be capable of doing that after they died and a dead body producing this burst of light? And that's what sort of led me to speculate regarding and then look, investigate further and make certain discoveries about how mind and matter could be connected.
Clearly, the shroud has been a source of controversy for quite some time. It's been examined to a point. Access to it is understandably limited. But and you kind of touched on this just a moment ago, but outline for us where the current schools of scientific thought are about the shroud, because I'm sure there's not a complete consensus.
You're absolutely right. There are many people who just got convinced by the carbon dating and then, you know, forgot all about it. Except, of course, interestingly, the gentleman who now actually heads the Oxford Radiocarbon Lab, which was one of the three that did the original study, has actually himself gone on the record in a program that was made for the BBC, the British Broadcasting Corporation, by David Rolfe, and the leader of the radiocarbon unit at Oxford went on the record to say that actually there's so much evidence that points to a much earlier date for the cloth than the date that the radiocarbon evidence came out for, that he felt much more research was needed to form a consistent understanding of the origins of this cloth, because there is so much evidence that points to it being so much older than that. And the thing is that we're talking about whether there's consensus about how the image got there, the first thing to say is that nobody knows how to make such a image now, even using 21st century technology. And those people who have tried to make replicas of it, to their credit, have even accepted the fact that actually they're not replicas, that right. they don't actually, if you look at it at a microscopic level, people like Gala Shelley with his attempt at it, it really has many different properties to the actual image on the cloth, which is really unique. It's only on the very outermost fibrils, 200 nanometers in thickness, which is around 1/5,000th of a millimeter, and it doesn't consist of anything that has been added to the cloth. It's explained chemically as an oxidation and dehydration of the cellulose in the cloth. It's basically similar to what happens to paper when it's exposed to sunlight and how it turns this sort of yellowish color. Well, this appears to have happened to form the image of a man, and the implication is, with the various things, including the photographic negative properties and the distance coding, that the just like sunlight can do that to paper over a long period of time, this appears to have happened instantaneously. When I say instantaneously, within billionths of a second, that there had been a burst of ultraviolet light, it appears, from this dead body. And it sounds like a bizarre thing to suggest, but this is what the scientific empirical evidence is pointing towards. And the book is exploring, if such a thing did happen, how did it happen? How does such a phenomenon work scientifically? And to understand how it could be happened scientifically, maybe we need to, as many of the founders of quantum theory realized, we need to expand our notion of what science is to include an attempt to understand consciousness as being fundamental to even the existence of material reality.
Maybe it's from the chair that I sit in, but it seems as though there are more and more scientists that are willing to accept what you just outlined and what you just said, and not specifically about the shroud, but about quantum science and this idea that consciousness is maybe part of a matrix or part of a dimensional connection. Do you see that as well within the scientific community, that there is a broader acceptance of this?
Personally, I don't see it as a dimensional thing or part of a matrix or anything that can be sort of made an analog to in terms of things or because I think I always see a distinction between the contents of consciousness, what we are aware of, and the actual state of being aware of it. So, for example, this notion of information, which can be sort of summarized in terms of ones and zeros that define computer programs and so on. Now, I would argue that however complex and long you make a string of ones and zeros, it's never going to wake up and be a conscious sentient entity. You can't make one who can perceive information out of information, and that's the vital distinction to me. But yes, there are still a minority, I think, but there is a quite a significant minority of scientists who take this view. And of course, one could argue that although it's a minority of scientists who take this view explicitly in their everyday lives, of course, they actually know it to be true, that consciousness is far more than a pile of atoms. That's why they care for their children and have a conscience and understand the notion of people being responsible for their actions because of free will. Now, if we were just a pile of cells and a gelatinous substance in our brain that makes our brain was determining all the actions that we did, then there'd be no reason to have any sense of morality or notions of credit or blame for what we did, because it was all fixed and determined. So this is the interesting thing, that the dilemma, that if you ask them, if you interview many scientists, they'll say, oh, no, it's just from the brain. But actually, subconsciously, if you like, they really do believe it's more than that. Interestingly, if you talk to the scientific researcher Rupert Sheldrake, who's done a lot of groundbreaking work on investigating telepathy and things like that. He makes the point that when he gives a talk to rooms full of conventional mainstream scientists, that it all goes quiet. They don't say anything in the question time. But many of them will come up to him afterwards when no one else is listening and say, actually, they agree with what he's saying, but it's just in public. They won't go on the record to say it.
So if what we're saying here is true, or at least partially true, or we're working toward finding that truth, where does that put the human race, human beings, humanity in this bigger scope of the universe and creation and time for that matter?
Yes. Well, I think that's the clue to it is time, because you see in the laws of physics, don't have a now. They don't have a present, a moment that we experience and are experiencing now and are always experiencing as now. The laws of physics would have for example, the Big Bang origin of the universe and the heat death could all be on one diagram altogether. There's nothing to demarcate a cursor, if you like, that points to a present moment. It's only for conscious being that such a thing as now exists. And Erwin Schrödinger, for example, made that point that the mind is always now, and therefore it's only because of the mind that there is such a thing as time, and therefore time is a product of consciousness, from that it follows that if time is a product of consciousness, then consciousness cannot be made by or destroyed in time and must therefore be eternal. And he actually went on the record as saying that basically we have no beginning or end as a sentient being in his book, which was called What is Life? With Mind and Matter.
We're talking with Dr. Andrew Silverman tonight. His book is called A Burst of Conscious Light, Near-Death Experiences, The Shroud of Turin, and Limitless Potential of Humanity. We mentioned near-death experiences, and you talked about descriptions of these experiences from those who have experienced them, being able to describe things that they would have no understanding of otherwise, being able to describe a procedure maybe that was happening to them because they were in an accident or a medical emergency, and they can describe this even though they were completely either unconscious or in some cases clinically dead. Yet other people, other scientists may say, yeah, that's a trick of the brain. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, if it were a trick of the brain, then how is it that they can accurately report what they perceived? These are called veridical near-death experiences. There have been blind patients who have never actually seen before, at least in that lifetime, if you like, never seen, and yet they describe seeing during their near-death experience. But the point is, of course, that there's two points here. One is the accuracy of what they're perceiving, and secondly, the fact that they're perceiving at all, the fact that they have a memory of the events that they're describing that happened during that they say that they experienced during that time, while their brain was not functioning at all. The brain waves are flat. They become flat within just a few seconds after the cardiac arrest. And yet, despite the lack of any activity in the brain, they were still having that experience, even if it wasn't an accurate description, which it is, of what was happening. How could they have that experience if consciousness is made by the brain and the brain isn't working?
So as people share those experiences and as you've researched these experiences, have you found that there's any commonality between what the descriptions are, not just of what they witness, but maybe what happens after they've witnessed? We had a gentleman on not long ago who talked about being ushered out of the room by some type of being. This is during his clinically dead moment, and having a conversation, a bit of a life review. Do those things ever enter into your conversations or your research?
Yes, two of the very common themes, and there's been a lot of sort of scientific empirical research on it. Some of it published in very prestigious scientific journals, such as Dr. Pim van Lommel's paper in the UK medical journal called The Lancet, and there are many others. A journal called Resuscitation has also had a lot of these papers. And two of the common themes are a very bright light and people having a sense that somehow this light is associated with wisdom, that all the answers are in that light. And also the light is associated with a sense of compassion, that they felt loved by this light that they experience. And then the other common factor is, as you say, the life review, which is probably even before the subject of near-death experiences was sort of known about. People used to talk about seeing one's whole life flashing before
That's you, right.
which is probably because that word got into the collective psychology, if you like, because so many people had actually experienced it. And the interesting thing is that during the life review, so many people say that what they experience is everything that they have done, but from the point of view of the other person. So anything that they did that was not unkind or harmful to another person, they feel what that caused to that person. And anything that they did that was kind and compassionate, they feel as though that kindness is being done to them. So they feel a sense of seeing where they feel it was right and wrong, but not in the sense of being judged, but of their own conscience being the arbiter, in a sense of natural empathy.
So quantum science seems to be the key to starting to explain these ideas. So what is it about quantum science or quantum physics specifically that starts to support this idea that consciousness is fundamental?
Yes, well, it was realized way early on in the when quantum theory first appeared by people, for example, like Eugene Wigner, that once you started to look at the way that quantum physics was being expressed, it was impossible to understand it without introducing the notion of consciousness, of the observer. And I'll explain why. Because, you see, in quantum events, for example, for an electron or a photon and so on, they don't have specific properties until they're measured. This is where until they're consciously perceived. This is where the notion of Schrödinger's cat came from. The Schrödinger's cat was an article published by Schrödinger, in a sense sort of poking fun at his own equation, because he was saying that this can't be complete. How can the cat both be dead and alive at the same time? Now, actually, what it is actually saying, it's slightly a little bit more to it than that, because, for example, take the example of the cat. It's not actually alive and dead at the same time. The quantum formalism would say it's alive plus dead, or alive minus dead, or alive plus the square root of minus one times dead, and all of these kind of things. Basically, which really equates to saying that it has no state of being alive or dead until it is perceived. The electron has no actual location until it's measured, and so on. And it was realized by London and Bauer and von Neumann that there was something called it was actually called the von Neumann chain of observation, that you could have a quantum event such as a decay of a radioactive particle, and then you have a detector, and then you have a screen where the result of that detector is, and then you have a person that looks at that screen. And what they realized is that in consciousness, we only ever experience it, things being one thing or the other. They're never, you don't look in a box and see a cat that somehow alive and dead, or alive minus dead, that it's actually consciousness that is singular in that sense. And therefore, that the end of the von Neumann chain of observation has to be the conscious observer. And André Linde, for example, the professor of physics at Stanford, makes the point that if you take the whole universe as a whole, then if you have what's called the wave function of the universe, so quantum theory applied to the whole universe, then nothing could ever actually happen unless there's an observer. On my website, there's a link to the interview where he explains how that's the case, and how to have time, you need to have consciousness.
And, of course, that website is andrewsilverman.co.uk, right?
That's right, yeah.
So as we talk more about quantum theories and quantum ideas, some interpretations will say that all things are happening at all times. All possibilities coexist. Is that part of what you believe? And does that do something to change our concept of free will?
Well, you see, I believe it doesn't really make sense to say that all possibilities happen, because You see, to me, the existence of consciousness involves the awareness of options, and therefore the capacity to choose freely. The only way that I can make sense of there being a present moment, a moment that we call now, is because the future is not fixed, and it's only through the notion of free will that we can understand fully why there should be what we call an arrow of time, why the past and the future are distinct. And this is something that a lot of physicists have grappled with, because otherwise you should be able to go backwards in time, but that would contradict causality, because the causation never goes back from the future into the past. And in fact, Stephen Hawking invented something he called the chronology protection conjecture, meaning that the order of time has to be protected. But he said there must be such a thing for causality to work, but we don't know, you know, what it is or where it comes from. And in the book, I make a case that what it is basically the existence of consciousness means the existence of free will, and what we call the future is just what hasn't been fixed yet, and it hasn't been fixed because choice is real.
Well, then let me ask this: based on what you just said, does that imply that time travel is not something that's possible?
Well, you see, the thing is that actually, when we say time travel, we have to be clear about what we mean by that, because arguably people will say, oh, we're all moving through time already. Although you can ask, what does that mean, moving through time? Is that 1 second per second? But actually, according to relativity, and this has been Einstein's relativity, and this has been verified by many, many empirical experiments, that depending on even and this is something that even satellite navigation systems rely on, that the rate of clocks varies depending on the strength of a gravitational field, and also varies depending on the state of relative motion of one clock relative to another object, and so on. So in that sense, you can, by going close to the speed of light or by being in a high gravitational field, you can then reach arrive at 2030, and less time would have gone by to your subjective clock to the other people who are sitting on Earth, watching the hours, days, years go past. So if you could call that, time travel, if you like. But I argue that there's no such thing as actually physically traveling into the past. Now, there is such a thing as in quantum theory, actually, called the delayed choice effect, whereby you can set up an experiment that can influence what the electron or the photon or whatever did before you measured it. And people say, oh, but that is sort of causation backwards in time. But the point, though, that one has to realize is that the electron or photon are not actually real and don't have actual fixed properties until they're observed. So your the past of it becomes real by the observation. It's not that you're actually changing its past from one thing to another thing.
I just want a clarification on something you said when you gave the example that you could arrive at 2030 prior to maybe others who would experience 2030 on Earth. Is that, in your mind, an example of time travel or a time distortion?
Well, it's more of a distortion, really. You would, in a sense, you'd arrive at 2030 on Earth at the same time as they arrive at 2030 on Earth, but to your biological clock and to the watch on your wrist, less time might have elapsed for you by the time you get there. Yes, it would be reasonable to call that distortion, yeah.
So if we're talking about consciousness being a non-biological function, does that start to add credence to the concepts like extrasensory perception, or maybe telepathy or telekinesis, yes, or any of these ideas?
Yes, indeed. In fact, I make the case in the book and explain why I say this, that actually when we say extrasensory perception, we mean perceiving something beyond the senses. Now, the senses are, for example, take vision. You've got your eyes, and the retina detects light and sends a signal, goes to the part of the back of the brain called the occipital cortex, and so on. But that's all just electrical activities in a gelatinous substance called the brain. But then somehow you are consciously aware of that. And that conscious awareness isn't part of the sense. It's not part of the eye. It's not part of the brain, as we can see from near-death experiences, where the brain stops and people still perceive. So what that means is actually your perception is all extrasensory. Then take mind over matter. Well, if you have actual, as you do, awareness, sentience, you can be aware of options and make free choices between those options that are available to you. Okay, so let's say you make an option, you make a choice. So I decide to raise my arm, for example, and then my arm goes up because I decided to put my arm up. Surely, if that decision arose in my mind, which isn't, I've just demonstrated how that wasn't, the mind was not made by the brain, and yet it's able to influence the brain so as to be able to influence my arm. That's mind over matter. So every single action we make is mind over matter. Every single moment of perception is extrasensory. So I argue in the book that these are totally natural phenomena. In fact, we don't even need to have such a word as supernatural or even paranormal. This is actually normal. That this is the natural state of being, is that mind is dominant over matter. Now, its extent of dominance may vary, and then I also go into that in the book to look at the question of what is the full nature of human potential, such that phenomena such as the one that formed the image on the Turin Shroud, for example, how we can understand that's an example of something that a human being achieved, which then leads on to not necessarily just the uniqueness of that individual, but showing how that potential lies in all human beings, which is actually, if it was, as the evidence suggests, the historical Jesus of Nazareth, that it was his burial cloth, that was actually what he was pointing to, because he went on the record, I think in the Bible it's recorded, someone told me it was John chapter 14, that everything you see me do, you also can do, and greater than these things can you do. So he wasn't trying to set himself up as on a pedestal and saying, you know, I'm much better than you, you can never be like me. He was saying, why don't you also do these things? But with the emphasis always on loving the neighbor as self, which is basically, again, in the book, I point to that being a very rational thing to say, because actually at the fundamental level, all consciousness is one. So your neighbor is yourself. And if you do that fully and undo the restrictions thereby that limit us in separation, and I argue that it's that separation which is where physical universes come from, because space, after all, is just the separation of points, then it makes, you don't have to have words like supernatural or miracle, that he was able to do the things that he did simply because of the power of how much he cared. That if you look at all the things, for example, the food for the 5,000 or whatever, it was all a compassionate response to through empathy to other people's their suffering or their need, and it was the sort of spectacular side of it. It was just totally incidental, and I don't think it was about that. He was just showing what the full potential can be.
So that gives me a couple of questions. I'm not sure which order to ask them in, but if these ideas are part of the human potential, why are they so difficult for us to demonstrate?
Right. Well, again, I would argue that we're demonstrating them all the time, that the fact that we're conscious shows us the extrasensory perception. The fact that we have free will shows mind over matter. And in fact, I mentioned Rupert Sheldrake earlier, but he wrote a book, Seven Experiments That Could Change the World, about how, for example, people actually, and anyone can do these experiments themselves, that how do people have a sense that they're being looked at?
Right.
You know, when someone's behind you looking at you.
That's right.
If there's not such a thing, yeah, you see, there's so much evidence all around us, which people who claim to be fully materialist and believe that their mind is just a product of a physical organ called the brain and nobody else's mind can influence it. And yet those same people will not realizingly contradict themselves and say, yeah, I just knew someone was looking at me. How did you know? You see, so it's not that difficult at all. And actually these experiences are very common, but we just don't notice them. We don't pay attention to them and we don't realize that the significance of them as an object of study.
And based on what you just described, as the actions of Jesus of Nazareth, we would up until this point, I guess, call those things miracles, but you're saying they're just the realities of consciousness.
That they're what consciousness can achieve. I would say that actually this whole physical universe of space, time, and matter is just a tiny dot compared to the full nature of existence, and that state of oneness of all being that people perceive as the light that they see in near-death experiences. It is the natural sort of normal, if you like, state of existence. But we are like when the physical universe began, most of consciousness didn't get caught here, perhaps, and we're just the last dregs that are left here, thinking that we are all that there is. But I think that reason and logic suggests that there's much more than that.
We're talking tonight with Dr. Andrew Silverman. His website is his name, andrewsilverman.co.uk. And the book we're talking about, his book, A Burst of Conscious Light, Near-Death Experiences, The Shroud of Turin, and The Limitless Potential of Humanity. Be sure to visit us on YouTube. Subscribe to our YouTube channel. Just go there and search for J.V. Johnson. You'll find it very, very easily. Also, subscribe to the podcast version of the program. It's a great way to catch up if you've missed one of the live broadcasts. It's available on all podcast distribution networks, at least the major ones, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, also Spotify and others. And when you subscribe, the programs download automatically to your smart device, whether it's your phone or your tablet or whatever it happens to be. Makes it very, very convenient. Again, tonight we're talking with Dr. Andrew Silverman. We're talking about his book, A Burst of Conscious Light. I want to bring up the idea, Dr. Silverman, of artificial intelligence. Is that an oxymoron? Is that possible?
Precisely. I would argue, yes, it is an oxymoron. And in fact, there was a nicely titled book by the I would call him a genius, Professor Roger Penrose, written in 1989, called The Emperor's New Mind, which is a sort of play on words with the Emperor's New Clothes that everyone's saying about artificial intelligence and whether actually such a thing is even possible, and how everyone's so quick to say, oh, yes, it is. But you have to be careful when you say intelligence, whether you mean intelligence as we see it as human beings, or do you just mean processing information? Because yes, machines and computers can process information. Well, so can an abacus can process information. So can an electronic calculator, but it's not aware of that information. And that's the point, that to be intelligent, truly intelligent, one has to understand. And to understand, one has to be conscious. And so the fact that machines can very effectively process large amounts of information very efficiently and so on doesn't actually imply that it's conscious, as one would say. There isn't something that it is like to be that machine, because there is no entity called that machine. It's just an object.
So there's a sentience issue here.
Yes. Precisely.
Is artificial intelligence, again, we'll use their terminology, not maybe what we would use here, but is artificial intelligence dangerous? Stephen Hawking seemed to think it is.
I would totally agree with him. In fact, about the danger of it. So, in fact, he was part of the CSER, the Centre for the Study of Existential Risk in Cambridge, England. And there's another one in Oxford, England, called the Future of Humanity Institute, where very learned people, which included in his lifetime Stephen Hawking, sort of gathered together and discuss the potential danger, existential risks to the survival of humanity. And a lot of them felt that one of the biggest risks would be the unanticipated consequences of technology. For example, you know, you have things like autonomous weapons and so on. And there's lots of scientists are campaigning against such a thing as autonomous weapons. But also, even if you have machines or robots or androids or whatever you call them that are supposedly programmed to make there be a good quality of life for human beings, one has to be so careful, because as many people have pointed out, if you program machines to make sure that there's no human suffering, then to a machine, the best way to make sure there's no human suffering is to wipe out all human beings, because if there's no one there, then there's no one can suffer, because there's no sense of anything. There's no sense, because they're not aware, so that they can't have empathy, they can't have conscience, they're just simply following a program. And people get fooled by appearances. This is the problem. So if you start making machines that have human looking skin and human looking eyes and so on, and then that machine speaks to you, then people will feel, oh, maybe it is conscious. But it's no less a machine than a lever or a vacuum cleaner is a machine. It's just made to look human, and we have to see past what things look like. I think this is the thing.
One of the interesting examples of the dilemma here when it comes to quote-unquote artificial intelligence is the idea, and maybe this is a very simplistic view of it, but I do find it a good point, is the idea that these self-driving cars, which seem to be introduced rather quickly, one of the things they can't figure out how to handle is this moral issue. Mm. If a self-driving car was about to get into an accident, and you've got a child in the passenger seat versus an adult in the driver's seat, how does that car react to protect either the driver or the child passenger? And these are moral decisions that machines can't make.
Indeed, or the pedestrian, or the people in the other vehicle. Yeah, that's absolutely right.
As we look at artificial intelligence progressing, and we talk about these dangers, is there a real danger that we may develop a machine that we can't control?
Well, yes. I mean, there's already the possibility that, for all we know, it's already been made. I mean, there were during the Cold War, there were so many near misses that because of you know, machines sort of misreading information and so on, that things that were not actually weapons were mistaken for weapons, and it was fortunately there were sensible people on both sides who actually managed on each occasion to stop it escalating. But yes, definitely that is possible that we could do that.
Let's turn the conversation back to the Shroud of Turin. This is obviously something, again, that has been in not just discussion within religious circles, but also scientific communities. And it's been the subject of a lot of controversy. A lot of people still maintain that it's a medieval forgery. You say no, and you you actually support that position rather eloquently. But again, remind us why you've taken that position.
Sure. Well, the thing is that if it were a forgery, there's several questions that one has to answer. How did the forger do it? Why did they put information on there that was only became apparent using 20th and 21st century technology? And how did they have modern day level knowledge of anatomy, physiology, and pathology? Because for it, just take a very simple example. In all medieval paintings you look at, they'll show the victims of crucifixion having a nail through the hand. Now, it was only relatively recently that it was realized by anatomists that that's not possible because the hand wouldn't take the weight of the body. It would have to be the wrist. But that's what you see on the shroud. It was the wrist. And they, you know, they didn't even have a sense of perspective in medieval art. In fact, there's an art historian, Thomas de Wesselow, has written a book about how the Turin shroud image could not have been the product of an artist and doesn't fit with any sort of school of art at all. And again, as I say, you come to the question of, well, how did they do it? Because even using 20th or 21st century technology, we can't manufacture an image with the properties that it has, the superficiality of it, as I say, that it's only 1/5,000th of a millimeter in thickness, the image that's together with the photographic negative properties and the distance coding, and just from the blood stains alone, blood and serum stains that so many forensic pathologists that have looked at it, that says it's almost like a sort of crime scene. You can tell from looking at the forensic physical evidence on the shroud that it did once wrap the recently deceased body of a man who had been whipped, tortured with a cap of sharp objects placed on his head, and he'd been crucified, and he had died before he was wrapped in the shroud. But then there's something interesting here that there were two different processes that go to make what we see on the shroud. One is very simple and simple to understand, that a dead body was wrapped in it, and so the blood that hadn't yet dried, that the stains were transferred onto the cloth and so on in an anatomical pattern according to where the cloth was draped on him. But then there's another, and that's the image that's on there. And there's some, the image shows that the and this was pointed out to me by a physician from Boston, actually, Dr. Gilbert Lavoie, that when you look, try and superimpose the blood stains in the image, they don't actually quite match up, because when the blood stains formed, the cloth was wrapped around the body, but then the blood stains from the face are superimposed on the image of the hair, as though the cloth was somehow flattened out by the time that the image formed. And this supine corpse that the cloth had been wrapped around at the time that the image formed appears to be vertical, because the hair is not hanging down at the back, but it's hanging down on the shoulders. And there's no, one would expect, even if rigor mortis was still present, and rigor mortis only lasts for about 24 to hours or so, you would expect from gravity that a body that, because the subcutaneous tissues and fat and so on are compressible, rigor mortis only affects the muscle, you should get flattening around the calves and the buttocks and so on if the body had been laid flat when the image formed. But that's not there. So it doesn't. He was actually, the body was upright, as we can see from the lack of flattening at the back and the hair hanging down, upright but not standing, because the feet aren't at the same level. So it appears, looking just from the scientific empirical evidence, that this dead body at the moment that the image formed was actually vertical and levitating above the ground, which is something that we can own, a conclusion we can come to using 20th and 21st century techniques from science applied to the information that's on the cloth. And it's just interesting that the fact of this floating above the ground and the burst of light both actually sort of match up with historical descriptions from the reports of during the lifetime of Jesus of Nazareth, if indeed it is his image, as the evidence suggests it is, that he was seen at times to rise above the ground or to walk on the water. And at one point, when some of his friends were gathered around him, they said that he shone brighter than the sun. So this is interesting that we're seeing similar things just using only sort of empirical scientific research. Now, I should say at this point, I don't come at this from a Christian background. Of course, neither did he, Jesus. So the religions formed afterwards, you know, in terms of people trying to understand what he said and represent it in different ways. But this is just from looking at the rational scientific evidence that points me towards these conclusions that I've written about in the book.
How much access does the church allow to the shroud? Obviously, it can't be continuously manipulated or samples taken from it. It would destroy it. But how much access has been allowed?
Well, they allowed it to be photographed in 1898, which is how Secunda Pia discovered the photographic negative properties of it. Because if you actually look at the image on the cloth, it looks vague and indistinct until you take a photo and you see the negative. For those younger listeners who are familiar with digital photos, in the old days when I was young, you took a picture and you got a negative which reversed the light and shade of the image, and then you had to go and get that developed. And so the negative of the image of the shroud is like a positive. It's like a black and white photograph of a human being. And then it was only allowed out very occasionally at that time. It didn't actually belonged to the church at that time. It belonged to the royal family in Italy, the Savoy family. And indeed, in 1978, the Duke of Savoy allowed the team of researchers who are known as STIRP, the Shroud of Turin Research Project, including eminent researchers such as Dr. John Jackson and Barry Schwartz, the one who has the website shroud.com. He was a member of that team as well. He allowed these scientists who were coming from, you know, work in NASA, Jet Propulsion Laboratory, Los Alamos, and things like that. They were allowed several days of round-the-clock access to the shroud to do all kinds of state-of-the-art measurements and observations upon it. And if you ask them, a lot of the people who are still around, they'll tell you that when they were, you know, decided to go there, at first they thought that they'd go there and find the brushstrokes in 5 minutes and then go back home again. But these scientists and researchers were all astonished that they couldn't account for how a medieval forger or even a present day forger would know how to be able to replicate this type of image. But then, you see, when the Duke of Savoy died in the early 1980s, he bequeathed the cloth to the Vatican. And since then, they haven't allowed very much. They did allow the carbon dating, which all the best protocols were all thrown out and by the carbon dating labs, and they only sampled one small area of the cloth that had been very damaged over history because it was right in the corner and had been repaired. So that's how. And you see, I was actually a student doing a science degree during my medical degree when the carbon dating paper came out. And even then, you could see there's a little box of the actual statistics of the paper, and you could see that the looking at it statistically, the three different labs, two of them had come out with statistically significantly different ages for the cloth, which was suggesting that even within that tiny 7-centimeter strip from which the sample was taken that was dated, there was variation. And of course, with the work of Benford and Marino, and later confirmed by the scientific research of Raymond Rogers of Los Alamos, as I say, that can be accounted for in terms of the different proportions of the much more recent material that was woven in the 16th century repair.
And that repair, was that part of, I believe there was a fire, there was some fire damage or something at one point?
No, this was different to that. Yes, you're right. There was fire damage, and there are clearly visible patches that have been sewn on to the cloth. But this was a different thing, using what was known and is still known as invisible reweave technique. It's thought that, as well as being damaged, that possibly parts of it had been cut off to be sold or given away as relics, and that then it needed to be repaired, and so it was sewn in a way to try and make it look like it was at first sight. But it's actually chemically distinct, and this is what Raymond Rogers discovered, that if you do a chemical analysis of that corner of the cloth, it's completely different to the rest of the cloth.
So the creation of the image, then, would that be considered? And we've toyed with the definition of the word miracle, but would you consider it to be miraculous?
As I say, I believe it's an expression of the fulfillment of the potential of humanity, of a human being, of what a human being can do. That because mind over matter, I'm arguing in the book, and I present a, you know, much more detail in the book, a case of why I believe mind over matter is totally natural, but we have become far less than our full potential. And this man, individual Jesus of Nazareth, showed how a human being could achieve their full potential. And he, of course, he always referred to himself as the Son of Man. I believe that's showing what a human being can achieve.
But I have to ask this, and you've made it very, very clear that you didn't approach any of this from a religious perspective, but are we talking about and are we offering what might be an explanation for what we consider to be divine?
Well, when he was asked about that, when people sort of questioned him about sort of saying that he has a connection to God, and he said, is it not written, you are gods, in the law? That he basically said that all of us have a divine potential, and when people referred to him as the you know, when he referred to his father as God, he also said anyone who does his will is my brother, my sister. So that would mean if they're his brother, then God is also their father, and we even said, you know, our father. So I believe he was pointing to the divine origin and potential of all humanity.
Okay, so I just need a clarification here. Does that mean then that we have misinterpreted those messages? In other words, Christianity pointing to a singular God is misinterpreting the fact that he was actually saying that we are God?
If someone tells me about a singular God, then I'll say, no, I don't think they're misinterpreting it, because to me, if I were to use the word God, and I don't use it much because it has so many meanings, it has a different meaning for each person who uses it. But the light that people see in the near-death experiences, the sense of oneness and compassion that they get from that light of all being one, for me, that is pointing towards the nature many people call God, and it is one, it is singular, and our separation as individual identities, each with our own particular pattern of limitations and restrictions and selfishness, lack of empathy that demarcates us out and makes us sort of self-seeking and so on, that's what makes us different to our potential. But our full potential would be the potential that was, I think, shown by that individual, Jesus of Nazareth, and showed how a human being can become the same as God.
We're going to run out of time, so I want to move the conversation a little bit. Where do these ideas and everything we've talked about tonight come into play when we start talking about intelligent life that might be non-human, or at least non-terrestrial?
Well, I would be, I suppose, exactly the same, although you mentioned Stephen Hawking before, and he was once asked about extraterrestrial. Of course, a lot of people might say, but is there intelligent life on Earth? Looking at, you know, world politics and so on, and so some people would say it's debatable whether there's intelligent life on Earth. But he made the point that if we have contact from extraterrestrial sort of civilizations, that we have to bear in mind the fact that it may be that what we call what they call the organic period of intelligence or of civilization, so-called in quotes, may be a short period, the time when there's actually living things there, that people like Stephen Hawking and many other scientists suggest that, as I was saying right at the start, that actually once you start to go down the lines of what people are calling artificial intelligence, there isn't that much longer that you actually have biological living human beings, because people go down this Yellow Brick Road of imaginarily thinking that they can upload their minds into a machine, which is a very dangerous thing to do because that's never you. You can never be summarized as ones and zeros. But if people go down that road, and human beings then become redundant. And so the point is that if it would be the same for civilization on another planet. So if we ever have contact from it, it may be that the contact that we would be or might be getting would then be merely machines, that it's not actually anything living anymore. But yes, I would say that everything that I've said would apply the same to a sentient being, wherever they are in the universe.
If we're talking about consciousness being eternal, does that then, by definition, support the idea of reincarnation?
Well, I think reincarnation does seem to make a lot of sense. If, you know, so many of people in the near-death experiences, they perceive that light, but they know that they're not completely congruent with it, if you like. They don't quite fit there. They're not as wise and compassionate as the light, if you like. So if we can't become that light, as perhaps people like Jesus might have done, then how do we continue our existence? And yes, reincarnation would make sense in light of that. And people, I address the questions of why don't we often remember past lives, and also the argument about people have said in the book. I also address the point that people say, oh, but there's more people alive now than have ever died in the past. Actually, that's not actually true. That it's actually someone called Joel Cohen of the Population Institute in the US, I think it was, did a calculation. There's been over 100 billion lives before now. So that's also not true. So yes, I do think that reincarnation is real. And in fact, we mentioned about Jesus earlier. It looks like if you read what he said, he was actually alluding to it, because when there was that debate about who do people say that I am, and what one of his apostles said, some say that the Messiah can't come back until Elijah has returned. And it's reported that he said, I tell you, he's already returned and you didn't recognize him. And the text then says that they understood he was talking to them about John the Baptist. But hang on a second. How could Elijah come back as John the Baptist unless such a thing as reincarnation was understood to be a normal, real thing by them?
Right. You've talked a lot about light. You've talked about a lot about the light, particularly in near-death experiences, as people will describe this phenomena. Are we using light here as a metaphor in some way? And if not, does that mean, and this is just maybe a naive question, but I'm looking for a distinction here. Does that mean there is some type of this presence, this divinity, if you will, in all light?
Well, the presence would be in all sentient being. And the thing about light, this was something that a professor of physics, David Bohm, was once asked about, and I give the full quote in the book, about why is light used as the interviewer used the word metaphor to him in sort of about the spiritual and the mystical. And he made the point that actually for light, and this is not controversial, this is Einstein's relativity equations show that light, for a light beam, if you like, there's no space and there's no time, in the sense that it's what the on the space-time diagrams they call it the null cone, null meaning zero, because there's no space and no time elapsing from the point of view of light. We were talking about clocks going at different rates and so on. So if you were light, if you were a light beam, if you like, your origin and destination have no distance between them, and there's no time elapsed between you going from one and arriving at the other. So if you like, light is the interface between our existence in in separation, as we are separate individuals, separate identities, as I say, that we're all less than that light that people perceive in their NDEs if we haven't fully realized all the potential of empathy, compassion and wisdom and so on that people see in that light. We're less than that. And each of us have a pattern of how we're less than that, that marks us out as individuals. And light is, if you like, the interface between this universe of space and time and the eternal non-temporal state of being. So it's not so much that it's contained in the light, but it's contained in the perceiver that can see light, and the if the potential is realized fully, then light happens as it did on the shroud image, and in fact not just Jesus, but if you look at historical depictions of people like the Buddha and many other people, why do people draw them as having light around them? Perhaps people had a sense that some people do have this radiance that once it gets beyond a certain point might actually be visible. But that's not really what this is about. The book isn't about sort of sensationalism or anything spectacular or a recipe book for making sort of miracles happen or anything like that. It's pointing to the fact that every human being in every moment that they're aware and conscious and can make choices is actually bigger in significance and scope than the whole physical universe.
Dr. Silverman, the book is called A Burst of Conscious Light. Is this something that anybody can appreciate, or do you need some kind of prerequisite information to be able to understand the concepts?
I would argue that it is, and this is what some of the reviewers have said, that it is actually written in an accessible style that people can understand. I've had some nice write-ups from a professor in Australia, but also from near-death experienced researchers such as Pim Van Lommel and Dr. Eben Alexander, the neurosurgeon who had his near and people have said that it is accessible, because I don't go into sort of equations and things like that, numbers and so on. I'm just relating people to things that are in their common everyday experience, such as the fact that they are aware, that they're conscious, and what can we derive from that? What can they derive from that as they join me on that journey to try and explore that?
And what's your hope if someone reads the book that they walk away with?
Walk away, perhaps, hopefully, with a sense, which maybe they already have, hopefully, of the wonder and magnificence of all and every human being, and an understanding of that we're not piles of atoms or cells, that we are eternal beings, and just realize that and value themselves and each other more.
Are these ideas, do they apply to all living things, or is this exclusive to humanity?
Well, I would say that, I mean, for example, for different levels of animal and so on and plant, we may never know to what extent an animal can perceive, but we, being humans, we know what humans are capable of, and so as a book written by a human for humans, it's mainly addressing humanity.
Dr. Silverman, where can people find A Burst of Conscious Light?
Well, I was going to say you can find it in all good bookstores, but of course people are all at home isolating and not going out at the moment. So although it is available in all bookstores when they open again, you can also order it through Amazon, or it is available online, or from the publisher in a Traditions, or it's distributed by Simon & Schuster to bookshops. As well.
As a medical professional, you probably don't have a lot of spare time at the moment, but any other projects on the horizon for you?
Well, quite possibly. There's already some germs of an idea for the next book.
Well, we appreciate your time. This is groundbreaking and fascinating and very, very interesting work. I appreciate you putting it into terms that we can understand. And most importantly, thank you so much for your time tonight.
Thank you for your time, and thank you so much for having me on the show.
Beyond Reality Paranormal is hosted by JV Johnson and produced by Orion Palmer and Slick Eddie Edwards. Like us on Facebook and subscribe to our YouTube channel. Please consider supporting the program either through your podcast platform, click on the link in the description, or on Patreon at Joha Productions. If you'd like to be a guest on Beyond Reality Paranormal, or you have a recommendation for a guest, contact our producer, Slick Eddie Edwards. Eddie is spelled with a Y, at slickeddieedwards@gmail.com.